Hi, TYT, it's Katie Halper. Really excited to be talking to my guest today. She's an activist, organizer, educator, and she's also running for Congress in the Democratic primary in New York's 14th district. So welcome, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Thank you so much for having me, Katie.
Thanks for coming on.
Of course, of course.
Can you tell us a little bit about how your kind of personal biography informed your politics and your decision to run?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different threads here. You know, first things first, I was born in the Bronx to two really working class parents. My dad was born and raised in the South Bronx while the Bronx was burning. So he kind of was raised in this period when all of these buildings were coming down in the Bronx, when landlords were kind of committing arson to their own buildings with families inside because the insurance payouts were higher than the rents. You know, from a young age, he decided that he wanted to put those buildings back up. So he became an architect. My mom was born in Puerto Rico. She was born she was born and raised all over the place on the island, but my family largely grew up in poverty in Puerto Rico. But my parents met out on the island and they got married. They came back and had me. And so I was born in the Bronx. And at a very early age, my mom, who had just come here from the island when she was around 23 years old, and had me kind of a little bit later in her 20s when she was about 26, she looked around and saw what the educational opportunities were like for children in the Bronx in the late 80s and early 90s. They were just not a just option for children. And it was really evident at a very early age that the zip code I was born in determined a lot of my opportunities in life. So my whole family, my whole extended family pitched in so that we could have a tiny house 30 minutes north of the Bronx. And I went to public school there while my whole family was in the Bronx, while my dad had a small business in the Bronx, while our whole real life was in the Bronx. And so much of my life was defined by that 30-minute commute between one zip code and another, between opportunity in one geographic area and the lack thereof in another. And from the time I was a small child, I knew that that wasn't right. I knew it was wrong that my cousins, who were 4 or 5 years old, that were just in a different zip code than I was, had different opportunities than I did. That shaped a lot of my thinking growing up. And when I eventually went to college, I studied economics, I studied international relations, I had worked in a Senate office, I worked in immigration affairs, and I really looked at what was going on with our immigration system back then. I graduated, I worked with educational nonprofits, I moved back to the Bronx. I worked with educational nonprofits to work with youth in the Bronx, in New York City, across the country. And, you know, when the recession hit, my father actually passed away right when the markets were crashing. And so this whole life that my parents had worked really hard to build was pretty much gone overnight.
And how old was he?
He was only 48 years old. And he had acquired a very rare form of cancer and passed away. And so my family, you know, my mom was back to cleaning houses and driving school buses, and I was back to waiting tables and bartending while doing my own community work. And, you know, I always grew up working, very working class, but it was definitely a situation where we had basically had to start from scratch.
Right. And how old were you at this point?
I was in my early 20s. So I was the first in my mom's side, because my dad had passed away, so I was pretty much the first generation college graduate. And so you put all these hopes and dreams, you work so hard to get your kid to college when no one else in your family had gone before. To have like almost all of those opportunities stripped at that time was very painful, not just for my family, but for families across the whole country. And I think that everyone kind of has their story of surviving the crisis, but ours was, you know, given that it happened at the same time of this very dramatic loss, was very, very difficult on our family. We were on the brink of foreclosure. Everyone was working two jobs. And that experience of working 18-hour days shoulder to shoulder with many other people that were in a similar situation. You know, people think of people who work in hospitality as like low skill or uneducated. But in my experience, many of the people working were just intersectional. They cut across the board. They came from all sorts of backgrounds. Many of them have college education. Some of them may not have, but were extremely well-educated in their own right. And there is no, you know, when people think of blue collar, they have this photo or mental picture in their mind, but it really cuts across all sorts of realities and all sorts of backgrounds. And so that was my life for a very long time. And eventually I kind of turned back to, I refocused on my organizing. I organized in the South Bronx with the Bernie Sanders campaign. And after the election, I went to Flint and I went to Standing Rock. And
Flint, Michigan, where the water crisis.
Yeah, and I had a brief visit there. I met with community organizers there. I met with people all over the country, but I ended up at Standing Rock when I saw exactly how corporations, particularly fossil fuel corporations, had essentially militarized themselves against American people. I realized that I had to do more. And it was right after I got off camp that a brand new Congress reached out to me and asked if I'd be willing to run in New York's 14th district. And when I did my homework and I looked at what was going on in our community, I felt like it was something that I had to do.
And it's interesting, you said against corporations militarize against American people.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
When you say American people, you mean, were you referring to indigenous people?
Yeah.
Or did you mean everyone in the United States? I'm just curious.
I think it's a cross-section of both.
Right.
You know, that was a movement that was centered on the work of Native peoples, of the Lakota Sioux and Native peoples across the country. But there were also many individuals who had come in allyship to amplify the work that Native communities were doing. And, you know, DAPL didn't really discriminate too much between those
equal
two.
Equal opportunity, all right. Oppression and violence.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how did Brand New Congress even find you? And what is Brand New Congress?
Yeah, so Brand New Congress is an organization that was founded in 2016. It was actually founded before the general election because what they saw was basically no matter who won the presidency, we're not going to get anything done unless we have a progressive Congress that doesn't take corporate PAC money in the 2018 midterms. So with that kind of foresight, they started to basically field non-career politicians with a history of community service and organization in their own communities and tried to draft them to run for Congress in the 2018 primaries. So they started that effort about 2 years ago. And they basically accepted community nominations for this process. My little brother nominated me during this process, and basically what they did is that they got like over 11,000 nominations. So they went through this whole process where nominations were reviewed and kind of kicked up and things like that, and they pretty much tried to match the incumbent, you know, how corrosive was this incumbent to our democracy and the role of money in politics. The community, how connected is this community to that incumbent? Is there an opportunity for change? And the nominee. And so kind of by mixing those three things together, does this nominee have a track record or does this nominee fit that community? Can we really make this a race? And it's really a grand experiment. And at the beginning of this whole thing, people were saying, oh, there's no way, or can you really generate that kind of energy and that kind of excitement around a midterm election as opposed to a presidential election? And really, I think at the beginning, no one had any answers. It was like, we don't know. We don't know if this is going to work. But if we don't try to change our democracy in 2018, how are we going to have any hope for at least changing? So with that kind of spirit of experimentation, they went for it. And I think kind of in that similar background myself, you know, I never thought that elected office was for me or would even be possible for me. I had worked with elected officials before.
Which Senate?
So I worked for the late Senator Kennedy.
Oh, wow.
And so working in that office, it was a really profound experience. Working with people in that office was really amazing, very conscientious, very just intelligent, compassionate, committed, especially going back to the Bronx and knowing how machine-dominated politics was. You know, I just really didn't think that the political culture of New York City would ever have me. And the way that I felt that I would have to change to fit that wasn't in line with my values.
You thought you'd have to sell out or compromise?
Yeah. And that's not to say that compromising is bad, but compromising your values is not something that I just really felt that I could do.
Right.
And so that's why I always dismissed that opportunity or that idea out of hand. But with this whole confluence, I think, of the progressive movement, of electoral politics, of what I think Bernie proved in 2016, that no matter how you felt about him, he was the guy that proved that a small dollar campaign was at least possible. I think that it was like, you know what, if we're gonna give it a shot, let's just give it a shot.
And had other people suggested to you that you run for office?
Well, I think I've had friends before that was like, oh, you know, like you should run or things like that. But for me, it just felt like so crazy. And it also just felt out of line because I had so closely identified running for office with you have to take big money, you have to work your way up this machine, you have to kind of pay deference to these party bosses. And that's what we've always been told for so long, that if you want to run for office, this is what you have to do unless you are individually wealthy. I think because I had interpreted running for office to be that,
right,
I always dismissed it out of hand. But now that I think we're kind of reimagining what that process could be like, you know, I hope that there are people out there, maybe one day, that are seeing how we're running this campaign and to at least see that it's possible. That at least maybe one or two or 50 people in the country are breaking through. Because a lot of times people look at all of these losses of progressives and they're like, oh, the progressive movement isn't winning. But that's what movements are about. It takes 100 people to try to lift that one person. You know, a lot of it is an odds game.
Right.
And thousands, if not tens of thousands of candidates lose every single year. That doesn't mean that it's not worth running, especially in our community where we haven't had a primary in 14 years in New York, 14. And when I first started this race, nobody thought it was going to be possible that a grassroots candidate would make it on the ballot. And we did. And no matter what happens on June 26th, I'm very confident about our odds. I really am.
Yeah.
And when I first started, the idea of winning was like called the unthinkable, you know? But if there was the slightest chance, then I felt like it was worth it.
Right.
Every day that this campaign goes by, that chance is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it is like, you know, overwhelming to even think about that possibility. But regardless of the outcome, the fact that we created the first primary election in 14 years in New York 14 is really, really important. And there are so many districts that are like that in this country where communities have not had an option in a generation. And that community itself has changed so much. A whole generation of people have come of age and have had no choice in who their official is. So I think that running in and of itself is a service.
Mm-hmm.
Running in and of itself can be a progressive act. And I think we need to reinterpret what success means a lot in how we run and the ways that we run, in that there are multiple ways to succeed. There's the big win, there's the big decision on election day, but there are a ton of concessions that you get in that process.
Right. On a national level, we saw this with Sanders, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't win, but he came much closer than anyone had thought.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself shows us that progressive ideas are more viable than we would have thought, right?
Absolutely.
So things that we used to dismiss as a pipe dream or impossible, we now see are viable.
Mm-hmm.
And just the way that, you know, he went from 3% to whatever high percentage. And of course, if we, the argument that people lose, like you were saying, if that means that we can no longer try those things, there should be no Democrats running, right?
Exactly.
Based on how
yeah.
many seats we lost.
Yeah.
We lost. They lost. So before we talk more about the organizations that have endorsed you and the parties that you're running with, can you talk a little bit about your opponent, the
Yeah,
the
sure.
incumbent?
So my opponent, the current incumbent, is Joseph Crowley. He is considered to be a very powerful member of Congress, largely because of his fundraising. So he's probably one of the most powerful members that most people have never heard of. And that's very
dangerous.
Intentional, very, yeah. very extremely intentional. He's trying to jockey to be the next Speaker of the House. He wants to take the seat after Pelosi. So he deserves a lot of public scrutiny and a very high public profile if he is going to try or want to lead this party. But he's actually trying to avoid that as much as possible, largely because of the fact that there's a lot of stuff under the hood in his career. He commands a very, very questionable political machine. He has presided over a lot of ethics issues around corporate fundraising, around a lot of deregulation bills on foreign real estate investment, on Wall Street banks, etc. And he accepts an epic, totally epic amount of money from private equity, private insurers, luxury real estate developers. 8 of his top 10 or 7 of his top 10 donors are primarily Republican financiers. So what he does is that he takes all of this money, he bundles it, and he doles it out to other members of Congress to essentially purchase and coalesce his power within the House. Additionally, what he does is that in an astounding conflict of interest, he is both the congressman and the chairman of one of the most powerful Democratic parties in New York City. And so what he does is that he takes a lot of that national money, and then he also translates that into very kind of high profit-making policy decisions by appointing people on local levels, city council members, state assembly members, that pass city and state laws that kind of promote real estate and Wall Street interests as well. And so it's done through this totally shady network of PACs, super PACs, LLCs, and so on. And this guy's trying to be the third most powerful person in the United States of America, and no one knows about him. And so there's a lot to be concerned about on a national level and on a local level for Bronx and Queens residents, for New York City residents who can barely afford to live and stay in their homes. A lot of that is due to our politicians, and they want to try as hard as possible to avoid that line of question. It would be a total nightmare for a lot of folks at their town hall to have a constituent ask their New York City Council member, how much money are you taking from real estate developers?
Right.
I mean, that would be a total nightmare. And so it's the biggest hidden secret in New York City politics, because we like to think of ourselves as a liberal city
right.
and as a liberal state, but in many, many ways, we are not. My campaign is highlighting a lot of that, which is making almost the entire political machine, certainly the entire Queens political machine, very afraid of what we're talking about on our campaign, and just very alarmed
right.
about the fact that we're calling attention to this.
So that's another way that campaigns, like no matter what the outcome is, another way that they really can make achieve progressive
mm-hmm.
victories, right? By just exposing something
mm-hmm.
that otherwise wouldn't be if there's no opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you can potentially move people in a more progressive direction. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we saw this a little again with Sanders and Clinton, where he pushed her to, you know, endorse $15 an hour
right.
instead of $12
right.
an hour. I didn't realize this, that Joe Crowley was like appointed. He's like a parody of an old school
yes.
connected politician, old boy network.
Yeah, so when you look at, when people say, oh, there's no way she can win this race, I go back 3 generations in the Bronx. I've worked in the Bronx, and I really understand my community. And I understood that no matter how much money this dude had, if I didn't intimately know who my Congress member was, nobody did.
Right, and you're
nobody
politically,
did.
Fairly politically engaged
yeah.
and curious and informed person,
exactly.
right?
Exactly, exactly. I knew that if I didn't know, that almost nobody knew. And so what I really kind of started to look at it when I started realizing, I was like, oh, this is strange. Our community is 70% people of color, and we've never had a person of color represent us in American history. And people say, oh, this is identity politics. It's not identity politics. It is almost statistically impossible. Right. That is a literal machination. And so I was like, okay, well, what happened? How did this happen? Was he elected? If he was elected, fine. We go up and we realize, oh, Joe Crowley was never elected to his seat. He was appointed by his mentor, who was the previous incumbent, Thomas Manton. And so Thomas Manton was both also the congressman and the chairman of the Queens Democratic Party. And what he did was, even for New York machine politicians, this was beyond the pale. It was shocking to so many people when Joseph Crowley was literally coronated 20 years ago. The Queens and the Bronx of 20 years ago is not the Queens and the Bronx of today. And it's a very different community. It's always been a very diverse community, but it's only gotten more diverse. And we are a very working class community. And the last thing that this community needs is a representative that advocates for the interests of Wall Street.
Right.
It's the last thing. And if it's, in fact, any community in the United States of America, it's a community that's 85% Democrat. It's a community that's 70% people of color. It's a community that's overwhelmingly working class. This seat deserves to be a leading progressive seat in the United States. And the fact that it's the opposite is totally unacceptable.
By the way, full disclosure, I'm the product of a mixed marriage, Queensian and Bronxian.
There you go,
Bronxian,
okay.
On my mom's side, and Queens on my dad's side. What are the ways that you will be making a difference? And mm-hmm. tell us about your platform and your policies.
For sure. So we're running a very unapologetically progressive campaign. One of the things that I'm very proud of is that although when I first launched this campaign a year and a half ago, we started with what we kind of almost take for granted now is the stock progressive proposals, things like improved and expanded Medicare for all from day one, fight for 15, you know, and a tuition-free public college and so on, and running, of course, without any corporate PAC money. That's for us is the starting point. And so what I'm really proud about with our campaign is that we've actually advanced the national conversation, and we've been credited with advancing the national conversation on really next generation policies. So we started there, and we have since worked with progressive economists and with activists. And so I was one of the first candidates in the country to come out in favor of abolishing ICE. I was one of the first candidates in the country to come out in favor of a federal jobs guarantee and really explaining what that policy looks like and what it entails. And because of that, we've been able to kind of lead the pack and show that the progressive movement isn't done in 2016. We got more issues that we're pushing for in 2018, more issues that we're pushing for in 2020, and this train is not gonna stop. And so the only way that we continue it is by advancing new ideas. And so I'm really proud that the community behind our campaign has really been able to be a platform because we are running in the district that we're running in to take risks and come out in front. And to kind of be that clarion call to the rest of the country saying, hey, this is what the future looks like. And that's what I think this seat should really be about. And because I'm running where I'm running, positions that would be very risky in other parts of the country are actually very safe
right. In
our part of the country. And so I think it's important that we do that kind of work as well.
You're also a DSA candidate.
Yes.
And a Justice Democrats candidate.
Yes.
Can you talk about those two?
Sure, absolutely. I pretty much would not be running unless it was for brand new Congress and Justice Democrats. At the very beginning of those organizations, when they said, okay, we want to field working class people to run for office, you have to make that happen. Brand new Congress and Justice Democrats have slates that are majority female, either majority people of color or very overrepresented with people of color candidates. JD is kind of increasing their slate all the time, but last I checked, they were majority female, majority people of color. And in order to make that happen, kind of in contrary to the DNC, you have to make that happen. You have to really scout out people Because a lot of those kinds of people like me say, I'm locked out of this process.
Right.
I don't have money and I don't have the social connections to make that money. Things like that people talk about all the time. When you go to any one of these candidate trainings held by many of these organizations, they're like, oh, call time. And it's like, who am I gonna call?
Right.
Half of my family's been incarcerated.
Right.
You know, like, how am I supposed to ask friends? Like, this whole idea of friends and family round is so privileged. And so
for fundraising,
for
is this
fundraising,
or just for volunteering, whatever,
in general, you know, the first thing they talk about is for fundraising,
right.
But even for social influence, for
right.
power mapping, things like that, it's just such a privileged kind
right.
of point of view. Is very discouraging to a lot of people of color, to a lot of people that come from working class
right.
backgrounds to run. And so what Brand New Congress and Justice Democrats did at their beginning was basically scout those candidates. And they said, if you're going to join us in this grand experiment, you know, it is a grand experiment for all of us, but we're going to try to give you a digital fundraising platform.
Right.
And so that's the only reason that I ran, by feeling like there was some kind of network, that there was some kind of organizational support, at least keeping an eye out on our campaigns.
And what is Justice Democrats? Democrats for
yeah. So Justice Democrats is somewhat similar to Brand New Congress in that, but they are focused on the Democratic Party.
Right.
And
they're not as opposed to Brand New
right.
Congress, which is bipartisan.
Yeah, Brand New Congress likes to call themselves postpartisan.
Postpartisan, right.
Because they will. So long as you identify pretty much as progressive
right.
and adopt progressive views, they don't care what party you run
right.
in. Justice Democrats is focusing on the Democratic Party, on trying to kind of change and command
right.
seats in the Democratic Party. So basically, with those two organizations together, trying to echo and really give a platform to candidates that otherwise wouldn't have had them, that's how we got really candidates like myself, like Cori Bush, like Anthony Clark, like Chardo Richardson, like Paula Jean Swearingen. Some of them don't have their primaries yet, or some of them just wildly overperformed in their primary. Like, you have Paula Jean.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, Paula Jean Swearingen, coal miner's daughter,
yeah.
running out in West Virginia. She raised $179,000 for a statewide Senate race, and she was outspent by $2 million. And she got 30% of the vote
yeah,
in
right.
West Virginia. That is
running against Manchin.
Running against
yeah.
Joe Manchin. That is unthinkable.
Right.
Unthinkable.
Again, she didn't win, but it's a real victory. And it does show once again that these things that people used to dismiss, whether it's someone running without as much money
mm-hmm.
or someone running on real progressive ideals, you know, it's just starting. So,
yeah.
of course, you can only imagine how much more viable it will become.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, we have DSA. And
right.
DSA...
Democratic Socialists of America.
Exactly. A group, an organization that is doing profoundly transformative work in the realms, basically, of social, economic, and racial justice.
Yeah.
In New York City, one of the really amazing things about DSA is that you see them everywhere. You know, they do the work.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, what attracts me so much to DSA, because there are a lot of organizations that have really strong, you know, viewpoints
sure.
and values and ideals. But in terms of walking the walk, I feel like DSA is quite unparalleled in that respect.
Right.
They do the work of centering marginalized people. They do the work of bringing conversations that would otherwise not be brought into the foray. And
right.
I think they're a very important part of getting elected. And you look at what happened in Pennsylvania, where you literally have three DSA-endorsed female candidates, and they just, by themselves, with their community organizing and their support, just dismantled these multi-generational political machines in Pennsylvania. It is totally shocking
yeah.
and amazing.
And they supported Jabari Brisport, who didn't win, but was a great candidate.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
and I'm very proud of the work that New York DSA is doing, because they're unafraid to jump into that realm. Jabari Brisport is another excellent example. He ran for city council, third-party ballot lines only, on Green Party
right.
and Socialist Party ballot lines. And he got 30%
yeah.
of the vote in a general election, which is amazing. And now they've endorsed me in this race for a congressional seat. So they're not afraid to like really swing for the fences with ambitious challenges that scare the heck out of the establishment. And they're going to keep going because they've also endorsed Julia Salazar, who's running for state Senate out in Brooklyn in a seat, which is like amazing. Yeah. And to have these candidates actually run, this is where ideas change.
Right.
And elections are conversations for the electorate. Elections are conversations for the community. And we need to be having these conversations everywhere. They need to be happening in activist circles. They need to be happening in the streets. And campaigns are a conversation. And for us to have that conversation with voters that would have never in their entire lives had that conversation with someone knocking at their door before, I think is transformative and it's important.
Yeah, DSA, I mean, I spoke on my on the Katie Halper show, we spoke to Erin Neff, who's a DSA person, and she was telling us how the membership just spiked literally the night of Trump's win.
Mm-hmm.
You could like see the numbers going up and up. So one of the silver linings of the Trump election is that I think it made people more open to kind of a departures from capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they realized the system wasn't working, isn't working, and they're now kind of openly embracing something called socialism, which was a bit unthinkable before.
Yeah.
I mean, I think part of it is also that the right kind of wasted their ammunition by calling Obama a socialist. If only, you know, don't get my hopes up. But I think that kind of destigmatized the word because he was so popular.
Mm-hmm.
Just going back to your proposal to abolish ICE, which again, I think is something that people would have thought of as totally unheard of from someone running for Congress. It's interesting. I forgot until I heard you talking about this in another interview that ICE is very recent.
It's amazing how quickly we forget that the entire Department of Homeland Security did not exist until 2003. And when these bills were being passed, they were almost immediately seen as broad, systemic, and disturbing overreaches of government power.
And violations of civil liberties.
Absolutely. And this all just started in 2003. ICE was created in 2003 when the Patriot Act was passed, when the authorization for essentially unlimited military force was passed, when the Iraq War was basically triggered. And ICE was right there in that same packet of legislation, that same little authoritarian movement forward. And we have since denounced every single piece of that movement except for ICE.
Mm. When you say we, you mean the Democrats or the left? Or
I think just us as a country.
Okay.
You know, in Obama's election in 2008 was largely a rebuke of a lot of what happened during the Bush presidency.
At least symbolically, right?
Symbolically, I would say.
Or he was more committed to that than he was able to achieve, let's say.
Right. But I think the electorate
was rebuking
the Bush presidency.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And the decisions that we had made. And I am, you know, it's one of these things where ICE just kind of slipped under the radar. And even 10 years ago, when I was a nobody, kind of picking up phones at a constituent office, I was picking up phones from terrified mothers who would come home and their gas stoves were still on because their families were snatched out of their homes with no recourse. And it was a black box system then. It's a black box system now. It's now getting taken up to 11 because we allowed that to happen. We created that infrastructure that was just waiting for someone with really authoritarian designs to just take it to the max.
Right.
And that's what they're doing.
Has the Democratic Party, the establishment, opposed you, done things to kind of sabotage your campaign?
We're kind of in an interesting scenario because my opponent is the establishment Democratic Party. It's a little hard for him to call in the cavalry because he's so strong. And if the DNC is really does mean they're red to blue type of stuff, which, you know, I think they do. I think they do really want to concentrate resources on red to blue, basically flipping red districts to blue districts. He is the establishment.
Right.
And so basically what they, you know, the machine tries to discredit me. The machine tries to say, you know, throw my own story at me, or they'll say behind closed doors, they say, oh, she's using a race card, or oh, she's using this or that. And for me, it's like to tell a candidate that's running in a district of color,
right,
that's talking about race, that we're talking about a race car, seems
right,
so obtuse.
Also, the Democratic Party, that's the same party that framed every single thing or criticism that Sanders had of Hillary Clinton as a straight white man criticizing a woman.
Right.
But all of a sudden, when it's people, when they like the straight white man and don't like the woman, and a woman of color,
yeah,
it becomes you're playing the race card.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, and
was
I
she
just,
playing the gender card?
Yeah, yeah. And I actually kind of tweeted about this morning with Abdul El-Sayed's race out in Michigan.
Yeah.
Because he's running a really transformative race, and one of his opponents, after making these ludicrous conspiracy theory-esque claims that directly related to Abdul's identity, by Abdul essentially defending himself and saying, no, I'm a normal American and these claims are atrocious, they accuse him of playing the race card. I believe it was a Republican that
right.
had accused him of this, but he has resistance even within his own party, believing
right.
that a Muslim man shouldn't even run for...
Like Keith Ellison, look what they did with Keith Ellison.
Yeah.
They appointed Tom Perez.
Yeah, yeah, and so I think that, you know, whenever you kind of have two candidates of different identities, no matter who the candidate is, someone is going to make that accusation in one direction or another. And it's kind of funny because it's irrespective of the privilege. It's not always the candidate that's the woman that says it. It's not always the candidate that's a person of color, whomever that says it. But that always becomes a conversation
right.
when a lot of the times we're trying to talk about real issues. And those issues, there is a difference between talking about the identity of a candidate and talking about the role of race in a community.
Right.
Because those are two very different things, and people sometimes forget that.
Speaking of DNC intervention and the establishment, of course, Tom Perez, after saying, so funny, he actually said that the primary was rigged, then he had to walk it back.
Mm.
And now, of course, he endorsed Cuomo, as did Governor Cuomo, as did Hillary Clinton. And I've heard you be critical of Cuomo, but do you feel like you're being racist and sexist, given that Cuomo has identified as a black woman?
As a New Yorker, I am black. I am a woman seeking to control her health and her choices.
I guess we were all open to choose our identities.
Yeah, I know, right. He identifies that.
But,
referring to a speech in which, not very well received speech.
Right,
where,
no,
where
totally.
And yeah.
And that's the problem, too, is that we just want to put on blinders to these issues. New York City is one of the most diverse cities in the United States. We're 56% people of color. We're majority female. Our governor, our mayor, our city council speaker, our state party chair, and the most powerful local party chair are all one gender and one race.
Right.
And what I said
they play
before,
the race card.
Yeah, and what I said before is that is like statistically impossible.
Right.
That is a system. That is systematic. And so the fact that all of these people, the excuse that they give is, oh, we can stand in solidarity with these communities. That's not good enough.
Right.
These communities need to have a seat at the table.
Right.
And the idea that we hand all of the most powerful seats to one identity and then don't want to talk about that in the most diverse city, if not one of the most diverse cities in America, is a big problem. Because the things that we don't talk about are what actually kind of add the kindling to the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And by not talking about identity, by not talking about race, by not talking about class, by not talking about the corrosive role of money in politics, we are creating a problem.
And didn't something just happen with making it harder to vote in working class areas and areas where there are people of color? I saw you tweet about
that. Oh yeah, so this is just a routine thing. The New York City Board of Elections admitted guilt and criminal negligence in how it conducts its elections. They purged over 250,000 voters from their voter rolls. They routinely swap out polling sites. You show up on election day at 6 a.m. and like people have jobs. They plan out when they're going to vote. And when they got to show up at 6 a.m. to vote before they get to work, to show up and the machines are broken because they haven't been tested, that is negligence.
Right.
To show up and you're not on a voter roll is negligence. To show up and the Queen's Board of Elections, which my opponent presides over, literally used Ancestry.com as their basis for purging voter rolls. And this is not a conspiracy theory. These are court documents that they have admitted to.
And the media doesn't cover that at all.
And New York City elections are should be of profound concern to everybody. But what people don't realize is that our own Board of Elections is politicized. Politicians appoint the people who run our Board of Elections. That is wild. It's wild. And when you have basically people who are the chairman of state parties who have very vested interests in who gets elected and who doesn't, appointing who works on the Board of Elections, it's just not a system that's even at the appearance. Elections are serious enough that even any appearance of a conflict of interest should force a recusal. That's what happens at the Justice Department.
Right.
That's what happens in almost every other proceeding that we see as sacred, especially our right to vote. Even at the appearance of a conflict of interest, people recuse themselves.
Right.
And the fact that our voting system doesn't have that same respect, I think is very problematic, because you look at folks like the Black Institute in New York City, they have an entire report called Mississippi on the Hudson that shows that in New York City, poll site changes, poll site issues are profoundly concentrated in communities of color. They don't happen on the Upper East Side. They don't happen in Union Square. They happen in Corona. They happen in Deep Brooklyn. They happen in the Bronx. And we can't ignore that and just think that New York State and think that voter suppression is a Southern problem. New York State was under review by the Civil Rights Act by the federal government. New York State had the second lowest primary turnout in America in 2016, second only to Louisiana. We have a problem. And the fact that we don't want to admit our problems is another problem.
Right. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you and when is the election?
Everything. Oh my gosh, please vote June 26th. Almost everyone in New York City is voting on June 26th. You gotta vote on June 26th. You can find me on every platform, Ocasio2018, OCASIO2018, Ocasio2018.com, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Get involved, pick up a phone, knock a door, because we gotta get elected.
Great, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, TYT. Make sure you go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow to see our extended interview with Alexandria.